Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. You know, in this day and age, most of us are looking for ways to stay out of debt, and it can be tough, especially for students. For a time, author Ken Ilgunas found the answer to debt-free living by turning his Ford van into an apartment while attending Duke University. Ken's branched out beyond the van now, and he's got a new book titled Walden on Wheels, On the Open Road from Debt to Freedom. Our associate producer Bethany Chafin talks it up with the author on the first half of the show. Then we head to the open road on two wheels and a sneak peek at the bicycle, Art Meets Form. It's the perfect blending of world-renowned custom frame builders, bicycle-inspired art. Oh, plus it's the first time ever that a USA Cycling National Championship has ever come to North Carolina. Peter Karoff is back at the keyboard with Dynamics in Classical Music, and organist Ray Ebert is here to share the sounds of the summer next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Did you know that the women's and men's Pro National Criterium Championships are going on in High Point, North Carolina this weekend? It's true, and art is playing a huge role in the festivities. We'll hear more from event organizers Chip Duckett and Jeff Horney on the second half of the show, but first, our associate producer Bethany Chafin has just finished reading a great new book, and she's here to share.
As interest rates for student loans are debated in the House and Senate, Ken Ilgunas' new book, Walden on Wheels, sheds light on the issue of student debt. His travel memoir documents a journey from $32,000 of undergraduate debt through a series of menial labor jobs, adventures hitchhiking across the country, and even a period as a voyageur, retracing an 18th century 1,500-kilometer canoe trip along the rivers and lakes of Canada. Ilgunas later enrolled in a master's program in liberal studies at Duke, but he promised himself that a graduate degree would not take him back into the world of student debt. So in order to fulfill his promise, he modified and lived in his 1994 Ford Econoline van in a Duke parking lot, unbeknownst to the university and his peers. He broke his silence on this method for staying debt-free when he published his story with Salon.com in 2009. His new memoir, Walden on Wheels, tells of all these adventures with honesty and sincerity. I spoke with Ken at WFDD, and he began by describing a meaningful quote he uses in the book. You mentioned a quote, I think it's St. Francis of Assisi. If you could repeat that, because I think it sort of summarizes your book really well and summarizes the categories that you've laid out.
I can paraphrase it for
That's
sure.
Fine.
So a laborer is someone who works with his hands. A craftsman is someone who works with their hands and their head. And an artist is someone who works with their hands, their head, and their soul. So I guess that's also kind of an arc of my story. I begin as this menial laborer paying off my debt. You know, I'm a cart pusher, I'm a tour guide, I'm a cook. These are just really repetitive menial labor jobs. And, you know, I begin to crave something more. And my desire to go to grad school stems with this desire. And, you know, I want to start working with my soul. And it's funny, like I go to Duke for no clear reason other than just to become a better, smarter person. But what I learn over time is, you know, I'm going there to become a writer. And I was able to use that experience and that education to write this book. So it's kind of this weird sort of Earl Burroughs snake eating itself in which, you know, I write the book to get a sense of meaning and purpose.
You mentioned some of the writers that you were reading throughout the time that you write about in your book. But I was wondering, as you sat down to write Walden on Wheels, which of those writers or new writers kind of inspired you in your writing style?
Yeah. So I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, but, you know, as a young male, but I would read some Liz Gilbert, Eat, Pray, Love almost every day before I started writing. Because I just love the way she wrote that book. It's just this wonderful combination of sincerity and self-deprecation. You know, she could be talking about this harrowing, emotional, you know, episode she's trying to get through in one sentence and then, you know, talk about a bowel movement in the next. And, you know, it'll make you laugh and cry. And I wanted something like that. you know, I really love the comic writers like David Sedaris, Bill Bryson, J. Martin Truce. These are great comic writers, travel writers. But they don't have that sense of sincerity. It's not about a personal journey. You know, they're just talking about something funny that happened to them. And I wanted this book to be something more, something, you know, something that'll sit with you a little bit longer after you turn the last page.
So what did your writing process look like? I know you mentioned having bought a journal during your time at Duke. Did you write daily? Did you sort of sit back after all of this, after those 4 or 5 years, and kind of start from scratch?
Definitely not from scratch. So this is sort of unusual, but me and my best friend, we would trade emails on an almost daily basis. And if we were going through a hard time, sometimes it was 2 or 3 times a day. And this was just us trying to understand ourselves, our world, our problems. So going all the way back to when I was a senior in high school, I have this huge archive of emails detailing my thoughts over the years. And not only did this help me become a better writer, it's the only thing that helped me become a better writer, but, you know, I could draw from these thoughts and bring them into the book and give it an unusual degree of authenticity. Later on, I'd get a blog when I started to go to Duke, and it was the same sort of thing. You know, I had all my thoughts and what was happening to me then. I was able to bring the book to life because I had just these rich details about what sort of tree I was parked under and the conversations I was having and the courses I was taking. So a lot of the book was sort of already written, but I did spend another year and a half working on it, kind of enriching those things, using the luxury of hindsight to, I don't know, just make it richer.
You had to keep your van dwelling a secret for a while at Duke. And you talk about some of the loneliness that came with that. And now I think about what was once a secret, now it's published for everyone to read about in all its detail. And I wonder if that's sort of a strange juxtaposition.
I mean, it's strange, but it doesn't affect me much at all. It's funny, like I have a blog, I have a book, I'm on the radio right now, you know, I've been on TV, and you get the impression that I'm this terribly extroverted person, but it's actually the exact opposite. You know, I spend almost all of my time alone and in silence, and that's kind of how I like it. I like reading and writing and gardening and going on jogs and hikes and that sort of thing. You know, it's not a big deal when I share my life with the world at large because there's no consequences of it for me. Like, I don't, like, walk down the street and people notice me. I don't walk down the street. So it's just not a big deal. You know, it's just like I'm almost emailing Josh. It's just something for him to read. And I just kind of feel disconnected from my audience, which is nice in a way because I'm able to maintain that solitude and that sense of privacy.
So if you're not walking down the street these days, where are you walking? What are you doing?
Yeah, so I live up in Stokes County, North Carolina, on a tiny farm with a retired newspaper guy, and we kind of live as monks there. We have 7 chickens, a garden, an orchard, a whole bunch of forest land around us, and, you know, we both focus on our literary projects, and it's a really quiet monkly life. It's not always that way. I'm often going off on adventures, but that's kind of my home base for now.
You talk about going off on adventures, and I know you recently, last year maybe, you had
this
big
past
adventure.
Fall and winter.
Could you tell us about what you did and
yes.
where you went?
So I walked across the continent. I walked 1,700 miles from about Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, all the way down to the Gulf Coast of Texas, and I was tracing the proposed route of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. That oil is coming from northern Alberta, the tar sands, which you know, environmentalists are concerned about for good reason. And I thought I'd walk the whole thing. And to walk it, you'd have to walk across private property. So I basically trespassed across the continent, walking hayfields and cornfields and cow pasture and grasslands. And it was a wonderful journey.
And are you writing about that currently, or do you plan to write about it?
I'm writing my second book right now. I'm going to call it Trespassing Across America. Comes the morning.
can feel that there's nothing left to be called.
So outside in our parking lot right now is the very van that you write about.
So I still have it, and you know, I probably should get a different vehicle because the gas mileage on that thing is awful, but there for sure is a lot of sentimental value with that van, and it's hard to think of my life without it. We've been through a lot together.
Tell us a little bit about the van.
So it's a 1994 Ford Econoline. It's got this really vulgar fade. The top is burgundy, and it kind of turns into black on the bottom of it. It's got lots of dents and chip paint. Some of the tint on the windows is peeling off. It's not the prettiest thing, but it's been trusty. I've probably only put like 11,000 miles on it over the past four and a half years, but it runs really well. So it's my Walden on wheels. It's my little cabin, but a van. But it's also just the sense that, you know, it's not just a van, but you can carry this simple lifestyle with you wherever you go.
So obviously in the book, at times you know that you're experiencing things that will be great stories. Was it obvious to you that you wanted to write these things down someday? And was it understood that maybe it would become a book even?
Well, when I went to Duke to live in the van, it was primarily just to get a graduate education. I think I recognized deep down that this could be like a story someday. So that was always in the back of my mind. And I always wanted to be a writer. So a year goes by and I'm in a travel writing course and I write about living in my van. It's kind of like a big coming out moment because I have to read my story aloud to fellow classmates. And they like the story. My professor loved the story. And she said, you know, Ken, you should think about publishing this. And, you know, I thought, do I really want to, you know, expose myself to the country at large and, you know, tell them I'm secretly living in a van at Duke? I said, you know what, why not? I'm sick of keeping a secret. I have this great story. We were in the midst of the Great Recession and people were buying homes they couldn't afford. So I thought, you know, a story about frugality and living simple, it would be pretty timely. So she had a connection at salon.com. I wrote the story for them. And before it was even published, before it even showed up on their website, I got an email from a literary agent in New York City saying, why don't you think about turning this into a book? So, you know, before I even published my first ever national article, I'm getting propositioned by an agent to turn it into a book. So my life is just, you know, I'm thrilled upside down, you know.
It's not how it works for most writers. I hope you know that.
I think it's probably a little more of
That's
a
great,
difficult slog. At first, I think, is living in a van even that exciting? I shower at the gym, I cook a meal in my van, I hang out in the library, I go to sleep in the van. Except for a few moments of drama, there's really nothing too extraordinary about living in a van. It's really just living like in a mini dorm room. But I thought about that agent's proposal more and more, and I thought, you know what? You know, if I tie in my past, if I tie in paying off my debt, tie in my motivations to living in a van and kind of structure it as a travel memoir, as, you know, adventure travel, then there might be something worthwhile here. But I'm still a student. I'd only been in school for a year and I still had another year and a half to go. And I almost thought about dropping out to write this book, but there just seemed something kind of wrong about that. And my instinct said, no, you're a student, stay in school, worry about the book later. And that's what I did. However, I always had the book in the back of my mind. So I took courses that would kind of help me prepare for that. For instance, I took an independent study and I called the course Student Debt and the Self. And I just kind of looked at debt from a philosophical angle and tried to understand what debt does to the human soul. And I also took two writing courses over the course of that year. For my final project in my last semester, I wrote the book in just one semester. And that would eventually become the real book once I edited it 7,500, 200 times or so. Over the course of this year and a half, I'm kind of making some sacrifices. That first summer, instead of going back to my Park Service job up in Alaska, where, you know, I'd make 12, 13 grand over the course of the summer, I decided, no, I'm going to work on a book proposal that summer and work on an independent study. So that was the first big sacrifice. So that didn't leave me with much money for the next year at Duke. So my final semester, I'm writing the final project. I'm writing the book, and I'm running out of money. My whole goal was to graduate debt-free, and if it wasn't for doing 8 MRI studies in which I had my brain scanned in the last week, I might have gone into debt. So I ended up graduating with about $1,000. And, you know, I begin to second guess whether I want to write the book or not, because, you know, I'm broke, I'm 27, 28 at this point, you know, should I kind of get serious and get a real job? And, you know, I'm kind of just battling with these thoughts. And I decide, you know what, I'm just going to go all out. I'm going to write this book. So I move up to Coldfoot, Alaska, where I talked with the previous boss, and he hooks me up with a writer in residency. I promised to work one day a week. He'll give me free room and board. You know, I was just really excited. I was writing my book. I was a writer in residence, and I wrote my first chapter for the book. I had it edited, and I sent it to that literary agent who I'd kept in touch with over the past year. And he stopped returning my emails and calls after I sent him that first chapter, because it was raw. It was raw for sure. And he probably thought, like, this guy can't write a book at all. So I was devastated. That was my only link to the publishing world. I, I had $1,000. I wasn't getting paid to live here. I'm writing a book, and, you know, it just looks like an impossible feat now. So, I kind of go into this depression that summer, and I just really begin to question my ideals and my values. Did I make the right decision? It's like I'm paying for all my idealistic sins, because eventually I was so broke I had to start working at this truck stop again. So I was kind of on this Scrooge-like tour of my past, revisiting just these menial jobs. Like, I become a tour guide again. And then the camp manager asks if I want to wash dishes, except this time it's going to be in Dead Horse, Alaska, which is probably the most miserable place on earth, right next to Prudhoe Bay, the oil fields. After that, I'm like, I'm going to get the hell out of Dead Horse, and I'm going to start this book again. And I found some literary agents after that. I moved back to North Carolina, really focused on the book. We submitted my book proposal to 17 publishers, and we got an offer, and everything's been good since then.
I'm sure you've gotten feedback, but what's some of the most striking feedback you've gotten?
Yeah, I get plenty of emails and Facebook messages, and I don't know, they're all very touching and heartwarming. I think they see me differently than I see myself. I almost feel like Chauncey Gardner in that film Being There. I think there was this short story as well in which this simpleton is perceived to be this presidential figure, and, you know, he doesn't even realize what's going on. And it's kind of the same thing. Like, people see me as some, like, adventure Henry David Thoreau of the 21st century, and I just feel like someone who likes watching the Buffalo Bills and drinking beer and watching Game of Thrones occasionally, and, you know, sometimes going on an adventure too. I think we need symbols and figures like that. So if they want to think of me that way, so be it. Go forward and
reverse. Author, blogger, and adventure seeker Ken Ilgunis. His new book is titled Walden on Wheels, On the Open Road from Debt to Freedom. You can find out more about Ken on our website, wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can find links to Ken's blog, information about his recent hike along the proposed route for the Keystone XL pipeline, and links to his other publications. Out here
Triad Arts Weekend, associate producer Bethany Chafin. I'm David Ford, and we've got bicycles, bike art, vintage bikes, and a first for North Carolina, a USA Cycling National Championship right here in the Triad. That's coming up just about 60 seconds from now, and Mr. Peter Karoff is back at the keyboard with Understanding Classical Music. Today, he'll be talking pianissimo, fortissimo, and everything in between next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This weekend in High Point will be the first time a USA Cycling National Championship has ever come to our fair state. That's great news for cycling fans and, as it turns out, art enthusiasts. In addition to hosting both the women's and men's Pro National Criterium Championships, the area surrounding the downtown transportation terminal in High Point will come alive with bicycling-inspired art. Theater Art Galleries in the High Point Theater presents The Bicycle, Art Meets Form, an invitational exhibition juried by Green Hill Center's Edie Carpenter. Opening reception is Friday, July 26th at 5:30 in the main and hallway galleries. There's five leading lights of custom bicycle frame building with some of the world's finest and their amazing frames on site, including Italy's renowned builder Dario Pegoretti. Vintage bikes from the 1930s onward will be on display too, plus there'll be live music, fun for kids, and a whole lot more. Mach Orange Bikes owner Chip Duckett is also a cycler, partner in a professional cycling team, and vintage bike collector himself. The North Carolina native has brought all of these interests together in helping lure professional cycling to High Point. He was joined by Theater Art Gallery's executive director and High Point native, Jeff Horney.
We have four gallery spaces there in the High Point Theater, and so we change those over 4 to 5 times a year. So we do exhibits, and we also do arts education. We've got 12 summer camps going on right now. We've got Art en Español summer camps for kids, where the kids are being taught art in Spanish, you know, to Hispanic kids for 2 weeks on top of other things we're doing. So we're anxious in getting out beyond the walls of the High Point Theater as well. But a lot of opportunity, and we're just the more resources we can get, the more we can accomplish.
That's right. We're certainly going to get a lot of visibility through this event because it seems like the Cycling Classic, the Criterion, is going to bring folks from all over the country, all over the world.
That we're going to have a lot of cyclist enthusiasts who may not have been in the galleries before, and they're going to come, they're going to have a good time, and they're going to come back.
And at the end of the day, I think you hit the nail on the head. That is the purpose of these surrounding events, is to bring exposure of different interests to others from different segments. So it may be the new 20-year-old who's racing a carbon bike, it brings him to vintage bikes, that gives exposure to a theater arts gallery, that brings awareness of someone who supported Theater Arts Gallery to Dario Pegoretti from Italy. It's combining all these interests in cycling and visual arts, and that is the focus. And I have to add, Jeff being part of Theater Arts Gallery has just been an incredible gift to that organization and has reinvigorated it, and my hat's off to him.
This whole issue of bringing the USA Cycling Professional Criterium National Championships to downtown High Point, y'all beat out Austin, Texas, Boulder, Colorado, a couple of bike racing meccas. How did you do it? What sold them?
Honestly, I think it's the facilities. It's very unique. High Point hosts the International Furniture Market, the largest market of its kind in the world, or trade show in the world, twice a year. And so there's tremendous facilities that are used for round figures 6 months a year, maybe 8 at most, and otherwise sit dormant. And the transportation terminal, in conjunction with all of the showrooms, the space available, great street layouts, video for security that we can use for camera streaming, for internet. I would say that more than anything was probably the ace in the hole and the ability already in place to host a large event.
And this is really the realization of a dream for the whole community, I'm sure. I want to set the scene so folks who have no background at all with that sort of environment and with the Criterion going on and lots of activities for families, for kids, and food. Set the scene for us, Jeff.
Well, let me touch on the exhibits that we're going to have in the galleries. We're having a juried invitational exhibit. We've got great response from artists really from all over the country. Most of the artists regional. Most of it comes from within driving distance of North Carolina, but we've got art from California, New York, Michigan, even Canada coming in. We've got 36 artists who are juried in, about 52 pieces of art, an incredible variety of pieces, all kinds of two-dimensional art, but also three-dimensional art, some great photography. We have an artist in Greensboro, Patricia Cook, who does full-size figures sculpted from recycled tires, which is really interesting. We've got some great photography. We've got a couple from High Point who are both cycling enthusiasts, Julie and Paul Passant, and they are both photographers, and they both have work juried into the show. We have Zach Lale, who actually works at Mach Orange,
yeah,
I believe.
He's our manager.
And he's done a great piece called In Flight. It's a large bird, soaring bird, made all out of recycled bicycle parts.
And Zach has made a good number of the artistic bike racks that are downtown. In fact, I'm afraid he's going to get so good he's going to leave Mach Orange. But it's really awesome to see, you know, that and the integration of these things. And even like Paul and Julie, you know, they're helping as team liaisons with the race as well. So there are a lot of pieces that come together.
This vintage bike show, old historic bikes, talk us from the early beginnings into what were some of the biggest advances and where do you begin when you say vintage? How far back does it go?
Certainly into the 1800s.
Yeah.
Most of these are called vintage lightweights. Mm. So it's collectors who collect primarily race bikes. And so you're starting to see most of those around the turn of the century. I don't know what will be the oldest bike you'll see, but certainly some from the 30s. From all over the world, France, Italy, number of collectors in the U.S. And this evolved in part out of my friendship with Dale Brown, who owns Cycles d'Oro in Greensboro. Again, people would think we're competitors. The reality is we're great friends. And have worked on a number of things, but he is very, very influential in the vintage bike world and collecting, has taught me a lot and asked him to become involved with it. And so he's lent credibility and resources and has enabled us to draw these bikes. A large portion will be from the 60s and 70s, what we consider the cutoff date currently for vintage bike, or what we call classic rendezvous period, is 1984. And then there are things called Keepers of the Flame, who would be the equivalent of the builders that will be in the theater galleried with Jeff's art. And they build hand-built steel bikes, although one of them will be a guy named Nick Crumpton, and those are carbon bikes. Mm. But they're all handmade, one-offs, and you really just have to see them to appreciate them. And then we'll have builders in Showplace, which we call the custom handcrafted bikes. Well, that's an extension of the five leading lights. It's just bringing more people in. But these bikes, of course, I'm biased, but they're quite incredible, and I think in their own right are an art form. I mean, it's a functional art form or an artistic functional form, however you want to look at it.
Sure.
In fact, most of these bikes are ridden.
How was it made by hand, and especially using today's modern materials, how you join these pieces and what's involved?
For instance, even the tubes originally were hand-formed and rolled from pieces of steel. The bottom brackets that the various tubes insert into are initially hand-forged and then machine-forged. But they're hand-filed, hand-cut, measured, hand-painted. Dario Pegoretti from Italy, he's very much known for his artistic frame painting. And in fact, he's going to have a very special paint job as it pertains to art and music in High Point. And that'll hit as the event comes around. You know, and if you go back to the earlier bikes, then you had handmade wooden rims, spokes that were handmade, and then, of course, production over time. So how does a carbon bike become handmade? Well, there's layups. There's some that are what we call lugged, where the head tube piece, the bottom bracket, shell, they are for tube insertion. Well, and then some people do layups and carbon wraps, but they're all done. I mean, and it's so amazing that different pieces, different types of metal, different sizes, different thicknesses of steel can make an incredibly different ride and feel. And certainly the geometries have a huge bearing on how the bike is used.
These are not just makers. You mentioned Dario. I mean, these are some of the best makers in the world.
Yeah, we're very fortunate. We have five builders coming. Dario Pegoretti from Italy, Peter Weigel from Lyme, Connecticut, Mark DiNucci from Grants Pass, Oregon, Dave Wages from Wisconsin, and Nick Crumpton from Texas. He's from Austin. And they, in their own light, are really leaders in their field. To have Dario Pegoretti here, and for that matter, Peter Weigel, is an incredible honor that they would come. And I have to really give hats off to Dario because he is sought after worldwide. And I guess he saw the vision. He really liked what we were trying to bring together. And I can tell you, even from an email I received today, he is just incredibly excited to be here. He's really excited about the entire event, about the gallery, about the races, you know. And some of the vintage guys, they're not excited about carbon bikes. In fact, many of them would just, it's anathema to them. And yet, I think it's important to expose them to this as well, so that it is the mix. But it's an incredible list that, again, you might see in New York City or somewhere else, and that he's here. It is along the lines of the Crits themselves. Why High Point? And I would say, why not?
The neon lights are flashing in the rear view of my car. I've been tearing down this highway, burning out like a shooting star.
It looks like a real feast for the eyes.
It will be. The whole name of our exhibit is The Bicycle, Art Meets Form. We didn't come up with that. That's not Tag's name. That was actually Chip and his group came up with that name. So, you know, they're looking at bikes as art. Before we even came along, I said, that's perfect. You know, I think that's, you know, that's what we should use for our exhibit. So we have one entire gallery that will be set aside for the five leading lights, and they will be beautifully displayed with bikes and frames and some other memorabilia on some custom wooden plinths, and it's going to be beautifully exhibited.
And I appreciate you all going all art all the time here, but I realize this is a sport, and this is an incredibly competitive sport. What is a criterion? And for those who've never seen one, could you describe it for us?
Sure. It's simply a closed course. Ours will be approximately 1.3 miles. 7/10 of a mile would be the minimum. And so the beauty is, envision NASCAR, you can see the racers coming round. And so as opposed to a tour like Tour de France, which is day races and it's stage to stage, this is all in one place. And people would say, well, it's only 2 hours of racing. Yes, but it's an incredible 2 hours of racing. But from a fan perspective, it's awesome because you can stay down there and participate. There are a number of things with inside the races which make it exciting. And then, of course, visually, we'll have large video screens which will allow you to see the entire race from the same location. But a crit is very high-paced. Think of these racers, top speeds maybe reaching 45, 50 on Centennial, an average speed well above 30. And when you think of 75 to 100 racers elbow to elbow, it's impressive.
Put me in the mind of the rider for a minute, Chip. I'm just going to use an example. When they did a route around, they had one around Haynes Park area
yes.
a few years back. I was struck, number one, by the speed coming down off that slope, amazed that they made the turn every time in packs. But the distance between the pedals oftentimes was just a matter of an inch or two.
Yes.
What's it like in that dynamic, and how do they maintain that without wiping out more frequently, I guess?
Great question, and part of it leads to what makes these guys professional. Well, they have risen through the ranks of categorized racing and have, not unlike a NASCAR racer, you know, there are a few that filter out that are special. And so these guys are able to race at those speeds that close. Do they think about the person beside them? Maybe, maybe not. If you're thinking about it too much, you're not there.
Is it just a feeling at that point? I mean, you've been there.
Well, in a trusting, you know, these guys have raced together and these women have raced together. Part of it is a comfort with who's beside you, where you are there. And that's part of the racing, is trying to put yourself in positions to sprint, to attack, not be in the middle of the pack, safer areas. And in a crit, the teams will protect their main riders. That's not unlike the tour. There will be people working such that at the end, their sprinters have a chance.
The quality of these races, and not just men, but women as well. This is
yes.
an unusual venue in that respect.
Well, and we're very proud. We agreed over a year and a half ago to host both the men's and women's national championships together. It's the first time it's ever been done in the U.S. that they're held the same time, same city. And we also agreed for the first time to pay equal purses. And our feeling is that in their own right, they each have excitement and fun and bring things to the table. So that is unique. So having both is going to be very exciting.
Hey, Jeff, what are you looking forward to most?
I think it's going to be fun. I think we're going to have big crowds. We're going to have a lot of music. There's going to be good food. I think it's going to be a really upbeat weekend for High Point. That's what we're all working toward. There'll be music both Friday night and Saturday night all day. There'll be a kids' zone. So it's a very family-oriented affair. A lot of inflatables, and Tag's going to be having you know, some spin art and some other fun things lined up as well. But I think it's going to be a good, fun, upbeat weekend.
When you say there's going to be music, we're not talking about just music, because those are great bands. Soul Fusion, I was just checking them out online.
And it goes like this. Take by the tongue and I know you.
So just great high-energy funk dance tunes. And then Nipso Trio was a new one for me, but great acoustic trio. These folks know we got mandolin, upright bass, and guitar, and wonderful voice. It's like that kind of raw acoustic, but with a nice edge to it.
Well, Mipso is Joseph Terrell is a member, and he is from High Point. He went to high school with my son and was a Morehead Scholar, and they got together at Carolina, and they're on a fast ascension. In fact, they were very gracious to hang around. They are going to be in an international bluegrass festival in Japan that they were invited to, and they're hanging around for a couple days to play. So I don't know what they'll be, but they're great kids, and we're very excited. So that's going to be a fun Friday night, which is just a lead-in. There's no racing Friday. It's just a party, fun downtown, many things, including the movie Breaking Away at the theater.
Oh, it's a great
movie. Just bringing all these things together, and people can pick their fun. And then the lead-in is the Saturday, and the idea behind Soul Fusion Saturday was, you know, a cover band that is absolutely fun, fast, and furious, just like the racing. So when the racing ends, we have 2 hours of high-energy music so that there's a party after the race is under the terminal. And that was the thought process. We'll see, but we're excited.
And the big opening for our exhibits will be Friday night. And so we hope everybody will come out, and we're sponsored by Newbridge, and we appreciate their generosity.
Absolutely. All right. And the best part about everything we've talked about, it's free. We're not charging the public 1 cent. For one thing, the only thing we need is people be engaged and come enjoy.
Mock Orange Bikes owner Chip Duckett and Theater Art Gallery's executive director Jeff Horney. TAG presents The Bicycle, Art Meets Form, an invitational exhibition juried by Green Hill Center's Edie Carpenter. The opening reception is Friday, July 26th at 5:30 in the main and hallway galleries. There's 5 leading lights of custom bicycle frame building with some of the world's finest and their amazing frames on site, including Italy's renowned builder Dario Pegoretti. Vintage bikes from the 1930s onward will be on display too, plus there'll be live music, fun for kids, and much more. On Saturday, get set for the national championship races and after-race party with Soul Fusion. The fun continues throughout the weekend, and you'll find links to all of the activities at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break right now. When we return, it's Karoff at the Keyboard and everything you ever wanted to know about dynamics in music, but we're afraid to ask. Then organist extraordinaire Ray Ebert is here to explore the tones and colors of organs in Winston-Salem. It's an embarrassment of riches, and he's pulling out all the stops next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the Keyboard.
Hi there. Today I'd like to talk with you about a word that we use in the musical world to describe the louds and softs of music, and that word is dynamics. It's quite obvious that the loudness with which you play a particular passage would deeply affect its meaning and impact. Just imagine, I don't know, the beginning of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, that dramatic opening, and just imagine if it were. It has a completely different impact. And so dynamics are very, very important in how we perceive music, how we feel the expressive power of music. Likewise, imagine a delicate piece like Debussy's Clair de Lune. And you know what I'm going to do. Imagine it extra loud. Yikes. It has a completely different effect. So like saying a word to a friend loud or saying that same word soft, it has a different meaning, a different emotional content. Likewise, the dynamics with which a composer asks us to perform the music completely change the way we experience it. But you see, there's more to dynamics than simply how loud or how soft. Most of the music we hear, after all, is not just one note at a time, but layers of sounds. And so quite often, a composer will have multiple layers of dynamics at the same time. Here's a piece by Robert Schumann from about, 1830. A beautiful piano piece called simply Romance. Now, the melody is actually not at the top of this composition. It's kind of buried in the middle down here. And the accompaniment is both above it and below it. And so here again, here's the piece, the melody in the middle and the accompaniment surrounding it. Now, let's just pretend that there were no dynamic differences there, and if all the notes were exactly the same volume, it would be actually completely incoherent. Listen to it once. This is the same exact piece, but all the dynamics taken out of it. Yuck. So you can see that with music that has lots going on, harmony, melody, dynamics serve not simply to make it this part's loud and this part's soft, but also to highlight certain aspects of the musical texture. In this case, the melody in the middle, more prominent. So we can think of dynamics almost like shading in painting. You know, if you look at a painting and some areas of the painting are more bright and they seem to be more prominent or more in the foreground, and areas more darkly shaded recede into the background. And that's exactly what happens in musical dynamics. Here's another example. This is a piece by Rachmaninoff from the early 20th century, and all kinds of dynamics going on in here. First of all, very much like in the Schumann piece, the melody is down below, and so if you're not careful, the accompaniment would actually hide the melody, except thanks to dynamics, we can hear the melody more prominently. Without dynamics, you would just hear the... So we have dynamics then for the shading, for the more prominent melody, but also within each level, within each dynamic level, let's say, you have lots of ebb and flow of dynamics. You have what we call, simply phrasing or expression, so that the melody isn't just a series of notes, but rather a kind of expressive, very personal, very warm, sighing, pleading melody, again, thanks to the dynamic inflections. So you see, this term dynamics, I can also just simply say the louds and softs within music, are very, very important from the composer's perspective, which material, which ideas, which motives, which melodies he wants or she wants more prominently heard, but also from the performer's side. How do we make it expressive? How do we make it live? How do we make it seem as if it's speaking to us through sound? Musical dynamics.
Wake Forest University professor and Steinway artist Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard. You know, Peter's covered everything from Bach to Brahms and beyond on this show, and you'll find past episodes on our website, wfdd.org. Ah, Sounds of the Summer, exploring the tones and colors of organs in Winston-Salem. It's a performance series that began back in June with a recital by co-founder, award-winning organist Timothy Olson. He played on the 1971 Charles W. McManus organ at the Gemeine House in historic Bethabara Park. Sounds of the Summer continues through August 19th, and along the way, organ lovers sample from the Grooms and Payne instrument at First Baptist Church, the Skinner and Fisk organ at St. Paul's Episcopal, and many others, performed on by some of the Piedmont's finest keyboardists. On Sunday night, August 4th at 7 o'clock, it'll be the 1978 Noack organ at Ardmore United Methodist Church in Winston. Sounds of the Summer co-founder Dreema Lovett will present that program. Dreema and Tim teamed up with Winston-Salem native Centenary United Methodist Church organist emeritus Ray Ebert to create this remarkable performance series. Ray recently dropped by to chat with me about the mighty pipe organ, Sounds of the Summer, and more.
Well, three of us decided there should be some more organ recitals in Winston-Salem. And so this spring, Timothy Olson and Dreema Lovett and I had an extended breakfast and laid some groundwork. And then we used something sort of new to me called email and did all our other plans.
Now, I know Tim is a soloist and Tim Olson, teacher at UNCSA Salem College mm-hmm. as well.
Plays recitals all across the country.
And Dreema is an organist, also choir master and music director at Ardmore United Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm. And she also teaches piano and organ students.
How about that?
So that's like a classic job.
So, I mean, you had that in common, but at the same time, three different backgrounds. Was it tough unifying them in terms of the vision for this thing?
Not at all, because we all love organ music, and we thought that there should be a big variety in the kind of sounds. And Dreema came up with the idea, Sounds of the Summer, exploring the tones and colors of organs in Winston-Salem.
Okay, which leads to my next question. I mean, the naysayer would say, oh, come on, why do I need to listen to a whole bunch of different organs? So what's the reason?
Oh, well, the first two recitals were in June, and the first one, the organ had three stops because it was at historic Bethabara.
What's a stop?
Three different sounds, three different sets of pipes. And then the second one was at First Baptist Church, and it had 93 stops.
A little variety there.
So I knew that we were onto something. When we took our curtain call, they stopped applauding, and I said, now, the organ today had three stops. And I said to Dr. Olson, how many stops will the next organ have? And he said, 93. And 80 people went, ooh. Well, that's 80 people at the next recital.
There you go. And what's the feedback been from the audience members besides the ooh?
Well, the numbers have been an indication that it's well supported. The number of people who came to First Baptist were between 250 and 300 people. And we didn't mind at all at the last minute printing some extra programs.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's work you like to get, a little extra work printing up programs. And so, I mean, I imagine those familiar with the organs, and we've got a lot of great instruments in this region, and those not, you have to be blown away with not only the quality of the performances, but these instruments themselves.
Mm-hmm. Basically, the person who's playing each time is a person who regularly plays that organ. So they know the organ inside out. They know the different kinds of sounds you can hear, and the organs vary. Like the one at Bethabara was very simple. The one at First Baptist, very complex. The one at St. Paul's from the 1920s, someone described it as the sound as liquid velvet, which I think is really cool.
Nice.
The one at Centenary, the acoustics have been restored to just about what they were in 1931, just recently. So now you've got all this shimmer in the room, which you didn't get 2 years ago. That's very exciting.
Yeah, the organist I speak to talk about the acoustic as being one of the most important parts of the instrument, in a sense. You can't separate the two.
That's right. Just as if you were a singer, you don't want to sing in something that's all covered with felt and velvet.
Speaking of that renovation at United, is there some renovation work going on with some of the organs themselves that we're going to get a chance to hear?
Oh, at Salem College, they have rebuilt the organ this year. They sent all the reed pipes back to Holland.
How many pipes?
I don't know how many sets of reeds.
More than a dozen.
Those are trickier to adjust and bring up to snuff. And that's sort of a traditional thing. And so then this summer, two builders from the Funtrop Company have been here adjusting the sound on the other pipes. So you'll find the sound on the Funtrop much warmer and a much more unified sound. It should be really exciting to hear. The organ was originally built in the 1960s. And there was a sort of different concept of sound then than there is now.
Was it brighter back then or darker?
Harsher.
Harsher, yeah.
That would fall toward brighter, right?
Yeah.
And the same at Centenary. So with this now reverberant room, all that sort of things that were too straightforward and a little on the harsh side are warmer and rounder.
Nice. Mm-hmm. How are things from your expectations going in and what's occurred so far with the Sounds of the Summer? Has it met your expectations with some surprises?
Oh, yes. It's been an overwhelming response. It's very interesting that none of the pieces have been duplicated. Each organ has got to choose what they wanted to play. And I think they probably, double-checked to make sure what they're going to play hasn't already been played.
Yeah.
But it just, each organ is different. So what on this organ could sound, wonderful, that's basically where they go.
And then coming up on Monday, August 19th, this is, for this series, a unique opportunity because you'll be hearing from multiple soloists.
Exactly. Students at Salem and the School of the Arts. That goes all the way from high school students all the way to grad students. I'm not sure who will be playing because that's Dr. Olson's in a job to figure that out.
Sure. And we get a chance to hear the Flintrap organ and all of its glory post-renovation work.
Exactly. And what's interesting to hear different people play one organ is that it should sound different every time. They make different decisions, different choices, what stops to use.
Keyboardist Ray Ebert. For 30 years, Ray was organist at Rinalda House Museum of American Art. He's now organist emeritus at Centenary United Methodist Church after his 40-year tenure there. Ray, along with organists Tim Olson and Dreema Lovett, is the co-organizer of Sounds of the Summer, exploring the tones and colors of organs in Winston-Salem. Sounds of the Summer continues next week on Sunday night, August 4th at 7 o'clock at Ardmore United Methodist Church. Dreema Lovett will perform on that church's 1978 Noack organ. You'll find the complete summer performance schedule on our website, wfdd.org. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Kathleen Coker. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, links and photos to all of our guests, and more at WFDD.org. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.